Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Eva Kaur. And Eva, of course, was in Germany at the time of the Second World War, and well, I'm going to let her tell her story. She's getting on in years, and I think you need to hear the stories firsthand from the people who saw the terrible things that happened in Germany at that time. Eva, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. I must, from the start, make two small corrections. I'm not getting on in age. I'm getting younger.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you tell us your story?
I was not born in Germany.
You weren't? Where were you born?
I was born in Transylvania, Romania.
All right. Well, you go ahead and tell the story.
Well, basically, I was born as a little girl, I remember, at age six, in a small, very small village in Transylvania, Romania. The village had only 100 families. All Catholic, and we were the only Jews. My father was a farmer, and when I was six, immediately within a couple of months after my birthday, Romania was taken over or occupied by the Hungarian army, and with the occupation, everything changed. First of all, my father had to go to the nearby police station to present himself every 2 weeks. He was on parole for being Jewish. If he didn't, he was going to be arrested. That was always a threat. Second, my twin sister and I, Miriam, would enter a school, first grade in the fall, and there was a one-room schoolhouse. We did have two older sisters that are already finished with that four-year school, and the school has been taken over by the Nazis. They brought in teachers controlled by the Nazi Party and books printed by the Nazi Party. And I remember a math problem in our book went something like that. If you have five Jews and you kill three, how many are left? That is the way I went to school. I also learned that kids can be very mean, particularly if they are rewarded for doing so. And in such an environment, I had great difficulty in trying to ignore what was going on with the ruling of the Nazis that occupied the village and the country. It culminated in our laws and rules and restrictions got more and more severe, and by 1943, we couldn't very easily leave our home. However, there wasn't a visible guard in the front of our house. We could at times go to school, but not at all times, because the village young Nazis and volunteers would surround our house and harass us for days on end at times. So it was impossible to poke our head out of the house because we would be attacked by rocks, eggs, and tomatoes. So it was dangerous, yet we couldn't do anything. By early 1944, things got even worse, and was in March of 1944, then two Hungarian gendarmes came to our house, ordered us to pack food and clothing, and we were taken away to a ghetto. In this case, it was a small
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. I guess this afternoon is Eva Kaur, and she was born, before the Second World War, or about the time of the Second World War started. She was born in Romania, and they were in a small village, 100 families. They were the only Jewish family there. And then the Hungarian military came in, and they took over the community. And, of course, they discriminated against her father because he was Jewish. And certainly when she went to school, she was discriminated against. And they would have, you know, questions in the math books. If you had 5 Jewish children and you killed 3 of them, how many would be left? And this sort of thing. And then, of course, their home was constantly barraged by the local boys who had gone along with the Nazi movement. They'd throw rocks at them. And a lot of times they couldn't even leave their homes. And then finally they were ordered to pack up everything, and they were going to be taken to a detention camp. So we're going to get back to Eva. Go pick the story up there, Eva, please.
Our ghetto was out in an open field surrounded by tall, flimsy, barbed wire fences. There were no buildings except one, the commandant's headquarters. And we were supposed to be there for 3 weeks and then taken on to a labor camp in Hungary. My question as years went by was always, who had the right to pick us up in our home? We have not done anything wrong to anybody. And yet that's what happened. In the ghetto, we stayed 9 weeks. My father was interrogated. His fingernails and toenails have been burned in an effort to find out where he hid all his gold and silver. And then we were loaded into cattle cars. And 4 days later, we arrived at a place called Auschwitz. We did not know, never heard about it. And within 30 minutes, after the cattle car doors opened, Miriam and I were left alone on the selection platform, holding hands, bewildered, never to see my mother, father, and 2 older sisters again. We became part of a group of children, all girls, all twins, age 2 to age 16. There were 13 sets of little girls in that transport. Somewhere else on that selection platform, I am sure there were little boy twins, age 2 to 16, and somewhere even twins, boys and girls older than 16, because that is the way we were housed in our barracks.
And I think it's important that people understand that this was being, they wanted twins for experiments. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, Eva was saying that, of course, they took her family to Auschwitz, and, of course, there she lost her mother and father, 2 older sisters. But she and her sister were allowed to live because they were twins. And, of course, the Nazis with Dr. Mengele were doing experiments on twins. Now, that's the same Dr. Mengele that was allowed by our CIA and our intelligence agencies to escape to South America, where he lived comfortably with the rest of his life. But we won't get into Dr. Mengele. But anyway, because Eva is standing there, she's with her sister. You know, they're bewildered. They're standing there on the platform at Auschwitz. They've taken all the others off to be killed, and they did kill her. Her mother and father, the people who try to tell you that nobody died at Auschwitz, are simply part of a disinformation program that is out there to confuse us about what really and the terrible things that happened at that time. You pick up the story, Eva.
Yes, that you're paraphrasing it beautifully. When people say that this didn't happen, I tell the revisionists, I know I had a mother, I know I had a father, I had 2 older sisters, uncles, aunts, grandparents. I have pictures of them, what happened to them. So once we were processed, and the processing included the whole day, standing and sitting naked, and then my tattoo number was done on my left arm, and I became, they heated a pen-like gadget and dipped it into ink, and they, dot by dot, they burned into my left arm the capital letter A-7063, Miriam became capital A-7064. Auschwitz was the only Nazi camp that tattooed its image. Once that was done, we were marched throughout the camp, and we arrived at a barrack that looked like a wooden horse barn, which it was really a converted wooden horse barn. Conditions were terrible, filthy and crude, and we were given bunk beds on the bottom, three-story high bunk beds. I couldn't sleep. I don't think human beings can function. And as I was tossing and turning, I noticed something big and dark on the floor. It was a parade of five huge rats. When I began screaming, mice, a girl from the top bunk bed said, stupid kid, these are rats. They are everywhere, so better get used to it. Well, we couldn't even now try to relax, so we went to the latrine. And when I entered the place there on the filthy latrine floor, were the scattered corpses of three children. Their bodies were naked and shriveled. And this is what I understood at age 10, that could happen to Miriam and me unless I did something to prevent it. So then and there I made a silent pledge that I will do anything and everything within my power to make sure that Miriam and I shall not end up on that filthy latrine floor. I will tell you that from that moment, when I left the latrine, I did everything instinctively. I never let doubt or fear enter my mind. In my mind, I had one picture, Miriam and me walking out of the camp alive. Also, the situation with children, the children lose their point of reference very fast. So during the whole time, I was in Auschwitz from May to end of January. I thought that the whole world was a big concentration camp. And every child in the world lived in a camp like I did, without parents, under such terrible conditions. And one important thing, particularly that we are approaching the 4th of July, one day late in July, I saw an airplane flying over Auschwitz. It was flying very low. It had the American flag on one of the wings. It made a yellow smoke circle above the camp. Then the Nazis turned on the sirens, and the bombers would come and bomb outside the yellow smoke circle. The yellow smoke circle was where the camp was. Would I have never seen an American airplane flying over Auschwitz? I wouldn't have realized that anybody was trying to free us. And even though I made the decision to live, one day blended into the other, and it seemed like eternity. That renewed my resolve to live one more day, to survive one more experiment. By the end of 1944, by November, the air raids increased to 4 air raids a day, and this is when all the experiments stopped. Now, the experiments were two types.
What sort of experiments were they doing on you, Eva? Was Dr. Mengele there at the time?
He was always supervising. Very seldom did I see him actually do the experiments himself. There were two types that I was using. One, he would place us naked in a room, 20, 30 sets of twins, for 6 to 8 hours a day. Every part of my body was measured compared to my twin sister, compared to charts. And these experiments were not dangerous, but even in Auschwitz, I couldn't cope with the fact that they reduced me to the lowest form of human existence, a mass of breathing, living cells. And the only way I could cope with it is by blocking it out of my mind. So Monday, Wednesday, and Friday was observation lab. Tuesday, alternate day, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday was the blood lab. There, they would take a lot of blood from my left arm. At the same time, they would give me a minimum of 5 injections into my right arm. Those injections were germs, diseases, and chemicals and drugs. The content of those injections we didn't know then, nor do I know today. After one of those injections, I became very ill a fact I desperately tried to hide. But the next visit to the blood lab, they measured my fever, and I knew I was in trouble, and I was taken to a barrack that I call the barrack of the living dead. It was filled with people who looked more dead than alive. Next morning, Dr. Mengele came in with four other doctors. He looked at my fever chart, and he declared, laughing sarcastically, he said, "Too bad. She is so young. She has only 2 weeks to live." I knew he was right, but I refused to die. I made a second silent pledge that I would prove Dr. Mengele wrong. I would survive and be reunited with my sister. For the following 2 weeks, I was between life and death, and I have only one clear memory. Waking up on the barrack floor, crawling because I no longer could walk, and crawling because I found out that there was one faucet with water at the other end of the barrack. I forgot to tell everybody that this barrack was not allocated nor food, nor water, and no medicine. The people were brought there to die. As I was crawling, I would fade in and out of consciousness, and I kept telling myself, "I must survive, I must survive." After 2 weeks, my fever broke, and I immediately felt a lot stronger. It took me another 3 weeks. They kept checking my fever twice a day before my fever chart showed normal and I was released and reunited with the other twins and my twin sister Miriam. But Miriam was very sick. And as I asked her, "What have they done to you?" She said, "I will not talk about it." And we did not talk about it until 1985 when she told me that for the first 2 weeks, after I was taken away to the hospital, that she was kept in isolation under Nazi surveillance 24 hours a day, that they were waiting for something to happen. She didn't know what that was, and of course they didn't tell her. But after the 2 weeks were up, she was taken back to the lab, injected with something that made her very sick, which we found out years later when she grew up and got married and expected her first child, that her kidneys, and she developed severe kidney problems, which ultimately killed her, that her kidneys never grew larger than the size of a 10-year-old child. That is one of the issues and one of the diseases that Mengele did do experiments on, and knowing Mengele's biography, he himself suffered from kidney infections. So it ultimately, as the war was getting closer and closer, the Allies were hitting the city nearby, near the camp in Auschwitz, outside the city limits. The experiment stopped, the fight and the war increased. Actually was bombardment sometimes 4, 5, 6 times a day. It never seemed to stop. And the Nazis ordered everybody out. They said, "We are going to take you deep into Germany to protect you from the fighting." I always used my childish mentality, which served me very well. I said to myself, I did not like those Nazis when they were winning the war. They were mean. Now that they are losing it, they are going to be even meaner. So we stayed in the barrack, and we discovered next morning that all the Nazis were gone. There were only, from the 150,000 people in Auschwitz II or Birkenau, there were 8,200 left. We were left on our own, and we found food in the kitchen and water, and it was difficult not to keep eating because we were famished. We were emotionally, physically starved. And then the Nazis came back on January 18. So they were gone about 9 days. They came back on the 18th. They marched us from Birkenau or Auschwitz to Auschwitz I. And they came back to blow up the gas chamber, the crematorium, and try to eliminate as much of the evidence as they could. In Auschwitz I, the condition, and then when we arrived in Auschwitz I an hour later, the Nazis disappeared again because the Allies were
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right back. You go right ahead, Eva. The Nazis, the Allies were coming. I guess the Nazis then tried to get away. What happened?
Right. And they were trying to actually get away, but they couldn't. Those the last group of Nazis actually stayed behind, and they were fighting from their bunkers. But we were on our own between the Allies that were approaching and the Nazis who were ready to kill. It was dangerous. Particularly water. I couldn't find any water in Auschwitz I. We were very smart survivors. There was no snow on the ground. I could have melted it. So I went to the nearby river one day, and I lowered the container tied to a string. And across the river bank, I saw a little girl about my age. She was dressed in beautiful, clean clothes. She had braided hair with ribbons in her hair. And she was carrying a school bag. This was the first time in 9 months that I realized that beyond the camp, there was a world where children looked like children and went to school. A few days later, the guns were silent, and it was January 27, 1945, that Auschwitz was liberated by the Soviet Army. For me to realize that we were free and alive, that we have triumphed over unbelievable evil, that my little promise that first night in the latrine became a reality. I also, in my childish ideas, I thought that once we survived, we would go back home, and back home meant my parents, my two older sisters. That dream never came true. We were, for another 9 months, we were in the Soviet Union in three different refugee camps. And then on October of 1945, we arrived back in Romania to our home to find out that no one else survived. Unfortunately, life handed us a lot of other challenges. Romania became communist in 1947. And communist Romania was tremendously impoverished. But what became even a bigger problem, that their slogans that they were spreading, and young people like me, who just came back from death camp, equality, brotherhood, were very enticing slogans. But I am always outspoken, and I always seek the truth. When I refused to participate in one of their parades because I told them that I thought it was more important to study rather than go to one more parade, I was called into headquarters and severely reprimanded. So I, in my own way, I said, well, okay, I don't like your party. I don't want to be in it. And the commandant of that unit, party unit, said, you are a very stupid kid. And I was 13 years old. He said, oh, we can kick you out of the party, but there is no school in Romania that you can attend. So I had no choice. I felt that at age 13, I still needed some education. And I was a very, very reluctant member of the Youth Communist Party in Romania. In 1948, we applied for a visa to Israel, and it took us 2 years.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, Eva was there at Auschwitz when the war ended and actually lived in refugee camps for 9 months, then went back to Romania. And, of course, by 1947, Romania was communist. You had to join the Communist Party, as even as a child, if you wanted to go to school. And, of course, she didn't want to be a member of the Communist Party, but she had to get an education. And then, of course, she had an opportunity to go to Israel, and visas became available. So you pick up the story there, and you're thinking then about going to Israel. Go ahead.
Well, the communist Romania did not want to give visa to my twin sister and me. To my aunt, who was raising us, who also was a survivor of Auschwitz, yes. The funny thing was that Israel wanted to give us entry visas, but not entry visa to my aunt. So it took us 2 years. That's why it took us 2 years to get our visas to exit Romania. They wouldn't let us take with us anything except what we could wear. And we arrived in June 1950 in Israel. Life in Israel was a wonderful experience. I could look at anybody, talk to anybody, and they were all Jewish. And I didn't have to have any more nightmares that somebody is going to pick me up at night and arrest me for being Jewish. In Israel, I was in a school, agricultural school, where for 2 years I learned to milk cows and learn Hebrew and language, and I advanced in my studies. And in 1952, I was drafted into the Israeli army, both Miriam and I were. Miriam studied to become a nurse, a registered nurse, and I studied to become a draftsman in the engineering corps. I stayed in the army for 8 years, reaching the rank of sergeant major. And in April of 1960, I met a tourist from United States by the name of Michael Kor. He could not speak Hebrew. I could not speak English. We had two dictionaries, which I still have. And we tried to communicate with two dictionaries, but communication was a really big challenge. And after about 3 weeks, he asked me to marry him. And the truth is that I didn't quite understand what he was saying, because looking up all those words in the dictionary, and I just wondered, I had an idea, but not exactly. And I said yes. And then I find myself here in United States in Terre Haute, Indiana, from Tel Aviv to Terre Haute. It's quite a jump.
It sure is. So now you're in America, and this is, what, about 1960 or so?
1960.
Okay, go ahead.
50 years ago.
Go right ahead.
Yes, and in Terre Haute, Indiana, our first child was born 1961, second child 1963, and I tried to fit in, but it was difficult because all the other parents, young parents, had big families. I had tremendous problem with birthdays and holidays. My children would ask at a birthday party, where is my grandma? Well, my husband is also a survivor of 4 years in the camp, and his parents were also murdered. So my children never had any grandparents, any extended family. Here and there, a cousin of mine or an uncle. My sister became an aunt to them, but she lived in Israel. So it was always a challenge for me to make them feel that they are not very much deprived, but that was not the case. They were. And somehow, with the hardships of being a citizen here who had a heavy accent, and the truth is that I could never understand why people had difficulty with my accent. Because I would tell, if people did not understand me, I remember I've been a realtor. I mean, I just quit real estate this beginning of this year. And in real estate, you get a lot of telephone calls, and you have to be articulate so the person on the other side would understand. And if I keep describing the real estate, the property, the home, and they don't respond, I have a feeling that I'm not communicating very well. So I asked the guy, sir, do you understand what I'm saying? I don't know if you noticed, but I have a slight accent. And yeah. The gentleman cracked up saying, no, ma'am, you have got a very heavy accent. And yes, I have difficulty understanding. So I told him I will spell the words that he didn't understand. But there is always a way to communicate.
Well, so, I think you speak very, very good English, and I can certainly understand you today. So.
Well, thank you.
Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment. Our guest is Eva Kor, and of course, she was raised, in Romania, and of course, went through terrible, terrible times in Auschwitz, where she lost her family, and I've talked to so many Jewish people who did. So why are those people today who say the Holocaust didn't take place? Ladies and gentlemen, our reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. Well, Eva, you go right ahead with the story, sir. You're here in the United States, and you're going ahead. You're selling real estate. And go ahead.
And in 1965, after being 5 years in the United States, I proudly became an American citizen because I said to my husband, "You are a citizen. Our son is a citizen. Our daughter is a citizen. I want to be a citizen." So I became a citizen. I have been a citizen ever since 1965, 45 years. And I immediately wanted to learn more about life in the United States. I was involved in my children's school activities, and they all finished high school, very good students. The reason they became such good students was just lucky. As they were little kids, I would read them storybooks. That was the level of my knowledge in English. I was very enthusiastic about understanding these books. And, of course, that was very important for a young child that I read them stories that I liked and they liked. So they became both very good readers, good students, and they then went on to college. Now, I began dealing with my own memories, dark memories from the Holocaust, not before 1978. They kept popping up. I never made a secret that I was a survivor. I never covered my tattoo number. But, for instance, my little three-year-old Rina came one day and said to me, "Mommy, you know, Mrs. Baker doesn't have a tattoo number." Well, she was spending a night with a little neighbor girl for slumber night. And when Mrs. Baker fixed breakfast, my daughter said, "Mrs. Baker, where is your number?" And Mrs. Baker said, "What number?" She said, "Well, my mommy has a number. I thought all mommies had numbers." And so then she came to me, and at her own age level, I said, "You know, the people who killed your grandparents also put a number on my arm, tattooed a number." So we resolved that. But I never made a secret out of it, except that I didn't really deal with the pain. I couldn't go back to it until 1978 when I began lecturing to schools, to universities, to churches, to civic organizations. And
Eva, hold that thought. We're going to bring all of our stations right back.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Eva Koren. She's telling about, really, of course, she comes to America, and she raises her children. And then, of course, one day she has to think back about the terrible things that she's witnessed, and she starts giving talks about this and trying to just deal with the horror that she's had to live through as a child. Now, have you written a book, or is there anything you'd like to? Do you have a website or anything like that
yes,
you'd like
to
get
on? Yes, I do have a website, candlesholocaustmuseum.org.
One more time.
Candles, one word, just like the one you write. Candlesholocaustmuseum.org.
All right, fine.
Because that's an organization that I founded in 1984.
All right, fine. And so people...
And I have three books, and I have chapters in three more. And the three books deal basically, one is for young children, which really starts with the prejudice and harassment in first grade, and it's called Little Eva and Miriam in First Grade. Second book I've written in 1995, it's called Echoes from Auschwitz, the story of Mengele twins, Eva and Miriam Moses. And then the third book was just published last year. It's called Surviving the Angel of Death. I also have a big documentary out called Forgiving Dr. Mengele.
Well, now, basically, do you have any idea why Dr. Mengele wanted to do the experiments on twins? Because there was some motivation. He did the same thing when he got to South America. Go ahead.
Well, from my understanding is, first of all, the Nazis and Germans at the time wanted to create a blue-eyed blonde Aryan race, and they also said that everything that's wrong in society, it comes from bad genes. Genetically speaking, parents have bad genes. So the idea that you could create, number one, certain people with certain characteristics, physical characteristics, and second, to eliminate the idea of bad genes, such as diseases. And it was very enticing, and many Nazi doctors and scientists joined the Nazi party to do that research. Mengele was himself a doctor and an anthropologist working at a very famous genetic institute in Berlin that was going to study that issue.
Was that the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute?
That's correct.
Funded, incidentally, by the Rockefeller Foundation. I think our people would be glad to know that. The Rockefellers were there funding the Nazi experiments. Big right ahead.
Well, everybody was funding it. That is what the sad thing is, that people thought it was a great idea. Eugenics, the word eugenics, is careful selection of parents in order to breed better offspring. And they thought if they could take care of that, that all the problems, ills of society would be taken care of. And for that purpose, they at the time studied voluntary subjects. But then the war broke out and the volunteers disappeared. And this is when Mengele was injured in the Russian front. They came back to the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute and asked his professor, Otman von Waschur. By the way, I am very good friends with Otman von Waschur's grandson, and I will be seeing him in August in Germany. We are going to be meeting some former Nazis. There are a lot of projects going on, and I have made some interesting friendships in the last 20 years. But he and Waschur decided that there had to be a lot of twins arriving on those cattle cars. And Mengele was dispatched to Auschwitz. Many German pharmaceutical companies realized that the twins were a great research material or fodder for their experiments, and they sent money to Mengele and to the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute to study germs, diseases, and drugs. And this is when it became deadly. And from the 1,500 sets of twins that were collected by Mengele from 1943 to the end of 1945, only 200 individuals survived. So it wasn't that easy to survive. They were not really interested in keeping us alive. They were interested in doing their research. I will say that I need to jump ahead because I'm afraid I will miss one important part. I do not ever want to talk about my experiences in the camp just for the sake of remembering it. In my opinion, the world is very good at remembering their tragedies. I believe that we have to remember for the sake of teaching and healing. And in 1995, 15 years ago, I actually met with a Nazi doctor at my own initiative in 1993 after my twin sister died. And he was very kind and very respectful toward me, which impressed me a great deal, and gave me enough courage to ask him an important question by any chance he knew anything about the gas chambers in Auschwitz, because the revisionists have been saying that for 65 years that there were no gas chambers and nobody was murdered. And Dr. Munch immediately said, "This is a nightmare that I live with every single day of my life," and described the operation of the gas chamber. I said to him right there and there, July of 1993, I said, "Dr. Munch, this is very important information. I would like you to come with me to Auschwitz in 1995 and sign a document just exactly what you told me. So if anybody ever says that didn't happen, I could take that piece of paper and shove it in their face." And Dr. Munch said to me immediately that he would love to. So this is the way that Dr. Munch and I got to know one another. I came back to Terre Haute, Indiana, delighted, excited that I was going to have an original document about the operation of the gas chamber, signed not by a Jewish survivor, not by a Christian liberator, but by a Christian Nazi who witnessed it. And I wanted to thank this Nazi doctor for his willingness to document the operation of the gas chamber. And I did not know how does one thank a Nazi doctor. I did not know where to turn. And first of all, I went to a card shop looking for some kind of a thank you card, and I looked at many of them, read for about 2.5 hours. Then I left there very discouraged because I couldn't find anything. And one of my life lessons that I give young people is never, ever give up. When you give up, nothing happens. And so I had to go myself back to lesson number one, and for the next 10 months. So about this time, I was not really in my journey, but maybe end of August, I began searching for what can I give this Nazi doctor. So when I was cooking, cleaning, doing the laundry, driving the car, and my mind was not busy, I kept asking myself, what do I give this Nazi doctor? How do I thank this Nazi doctor? And lots of ideas popped into my head until 10 months later, the following simple idea. How about a letter of forgiveness from me to Dr. Mutch? I realized immediately that that was a very meaningful and unique gift. But I discovered for myself that I, the little victim of almost 50 years, had the power to forgive. No one could give me that power and no one could take it away. It was all mine to use. We have to understand that all victims on the face of this earth are hurt, are angry, feel hopeless, feel helpless, and feel powerless. That is the way victims operate. I discovered that I had one power. And I began writing my letter to Dr. Munch. And concerned about my English spelling, I contacted a former professor to correct my spelling, and she said to me, Eva, that's very nice that you are forgiving this Nazi Dr. Munch. Please promise me that you will think about forgiving Dr. Mengele. And I promised her, and once I realized that I, the little nobody, even had the power to forgive the God of Auschwitz, and I said, wow, I do have that power. I am not hurting anybody, so why couldn't I do it? So we arrived in Auschwitz. I came with my children. Dr. Munch came with his children. Dr. Munch signed his document about the gas chamber. He had no idea that I was going to give him anything. And then I took out my document, I read it, and signed it. And there were 6 witnesses who witnessed my signature who also signed it, as well as Dr. Munch's signature. He was stunned. My burden, almost like a load, was lifted from my shoulder. I was no longer a victim of Auschwitz. I was no longer a prisoner of my tragic past. I was finally free. The day I forgave the Nazis, I also forgave my parents, whom I hated all my life. And people might ask me, why did I hate my parents? I believe that all the children in the world expect their parents to protect them. Mine could not. And as I was growing up as a teenager, I would often say to myself, if my parents would have saved me from a destiny in Auschwitz, if my parents would have saved me from a destiny of growing up as an orphan, my life would have been much better, and I was right about that. But I finally understood that my parents did the best that they could. So I forgave quietly. I forgave them for hating them for what they did or couldn't do, and I forgave myself for hating my parents. I believe that forgiveness is nothing more and nothing less but an act of self-healing, an act of taking control back over one's life. Jokingly, but maybe seriously, I'm saying often that forgiveness may be the modern miracle medicine, One does not need to belong to an HMO. There is no copay. It's free. Everybody can afford it. It works. It has no side effects. And if somebody is worried that by forgiving those who perpetrated the pain and the crimes will make them somehow feel like nobody or they will miss that pain, I have news for them. There is no pain police that will stop you. You can go and get your pain back. I doubt it that anybody would want to take back that pain. I also believe if we understand that what happens in a victim's mentality is what makes, we have to ask the question, what makes a person a victim? When people who are more powerful take away our rights and our power to rule our own bodies and our own minds and our own lives. And therefore, the idea that I have used the last power that I had, the power to forgive, I have restored my own being as an independent person in charge of my own life. And interestingly, as I'm talking to you, I have forgiven Mengele, and you know that if Mengele heard that today, there is not one single thing that he can do to take away my forgiveness, can he?
No.
So who has the real power? Now, people sometimes will say, the Nazis, Mengele, and all these perpetrators do not deserve it. That could probably be true, but I will say that I deserve it. And if we really understand forgiveness, the forgiveness is not for the perpetrator. The forgiveness is for the victim to be able to reclaim their own life and go on. And I believe that every victim on the face of this earth deserves to be free from what people have done to them. Therefore, a person in pain, in my opinion, with angry, pain and anger are seeds for war. Forgiveness is a seed for peace. So when any of these atrocities happen, instead of having all these big movies and shows about catching so-and-so, Mengele, the other Nazis, Nazi hunting, has not done one single good for the victims. What I like about forgiveness is that it immediately heals the victim. It's a doable thing. But also, it spreads the seed of peace.
Well, I think that's beautifully said, and you're absolutely right. If you maintain your hatred, why, of course, you become the ultimate loser.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. And I know that I receive thousands of letters a year from people who have seen my film, Forgiving Dr. Mengele, which you can get at Netflix, you can get at the Blockbuster Video, and you can get also at our website, CandlesHolocaustMuseum.org. And in that is an 82-minute documentary about forgiveness and my meeting with Dr. Munch. And people write to me, and I will tell you that the greatest tragedy that I see now in the United States is young children, teenagers who are abused, who are neglected, who say there is nobody at home to take care of me either. And that is in the United States. And this is not done by any enemy. It's done by parents who are supposed to protect and love their children. So when I speak to many schools, sometimes I have as many as 50% of the school write me letters that there is nobody in their life who cares about them and how do they go on. And that is a very difficult fact that it's happening in this great country.
Yes, it is, and I think it's really such a shame. And of course, the tragedy is many times the very structure of our society is breaking down. The relationship of the family is going. Now, these things are not happening by accident. They're happening, I believe, by intent. But be that as it may, harboring anger and frustration certainly is no solution. Our guest is Eva Kaur. Eva, one more time, please put out your website for our listeners.
Go to candlesholocaustmuseum.org.
Now, how do you spell candles?
C-A-N-D-L-E-S.
Candles Holocaust Museum.
It's an acronym for Children of Auschwitz Nazi Deadly Lab Experiment Survivors.
All right, fine. Hang on there. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up today's program. Well, we have 3 minutes, and then I'll let you go. But it's a wonderful, wonderful story, and I just appreciate so much your sharing it with our listeners out across America.
You are welcome, Dr. Stan. It has been a pleasure talking to you.
Now, do you have something, maybe a 2 or 3 minute wrap-up of your feelings, a message you would like to leave with our listeners?
I would like, number one, just like I always tell my, remember that each person has the right to live free, and if you feel that you are not free because somebody hurt you, you have the power to change that. Number two, the only way we change anything, even when we live in a free country, is by not giving up, and no one can make you do that. It's up to you to not give up on yourself, not give up on your dreams. And you don't give up on yourself and on your dreams, everything beautiful in life is possible. And by the way, I am going to go to Germany next month, and I will be meeting with former Nazis at the Buchenwald camp, lecturing there, because they want to be forgiven. They are tormented by what they have done. And I think that maybe that will help them. I am also just received a letter today from Germany that the German parliament invited me to speak there in January. And what am I going to tell them? I'm going to tell them, you, the German people, need to forgive Hitler. He not only ruined the rest of the world, he ruined Germany and left them a legacy of tremendous burden. And I tell them that they, the German people, deserve to be free from that. Most of these Germans, they're not even alive, yet they are carrying the burden of what Hitler has done. And so I see how that is going to go. It's a new experience for me to lecture to an official government body such as the German parliament.
Well, I think God is using you for a specific purpose.
Thank you very much.
Anyway, our guest has been Eva Kaur, and God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us, and it's been a real...
Happy 4th of July to everybody.
And thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, fine. Well, of course, that was Eva Kaur, and we do hope that you will, of course, remember what she had to say. There is so much disinformation out there, what really happened with the Holocaust, and we'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up this afternoon's program here at Radio Liberty as we talk about how this applies to what's going on today. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We do hope you enjoyed the program with Eva, and certainly our good friend Joyce Riley had told me I had to get Eva on, and Joyce was absolutely right. We have a 4-tape set of the Holocaust, and it's basically interviews with other people who were there in Hitler's, in Germany at that time. And you need to understand that these things really did take place. But the question is, why did they take place? And the reason they took place is because there was organized evil in the world, and of course it exists today. Actually, it was the CIA and the MI6 that helped Martin Bormann and Dr. Mengele and Klaus Barbie and Adolf Eichmann and 10,000 other German Nazis escaped to South America in something known as the RAT line, R-A-T line. You can look it up on the internet. You can check what we're saying. And then, of course, they brought thousands of the Nazi war criminal scientists who had carried out some of these terrible experiments to the United States. And to continue their terrible experiments, because we think about the people who worked in the space program, but they don't tell you about the doctors who worked on the psychological programs, who continued terrible experiments on American children, and certainly those who were working to create new diseases, and some of the terrible diseases we have afflicting people today, like chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia. We can thank our friends from the Nazi Party. You're not going to hear about that, but we have a four-tape set called Operation Paperclip. You need to get it. You need to listen to it. You need to understand the forces at work, the dark and sinister forces. Who backed Adolf Hitler? Well, you, of course, need to get Professor Sutton's book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. If you want to know who actually provided the military equipment, why, of course, we'll be glad to send you a copy of the letter I found in Colonel House's papers by Ambassador William Dodd writing to Colonel House in 1936 saying, why are American corporations, 100 of them here, building up the war machine for Adolf Hitler? Remember, he came to power in 1933, and by 1939 he was challenging the world. How could he possibly have done that? He had no money, he had no military. Oh, but he had powerful friends right here in the United States. And behind that, of course, you check the corporations out. They were many tied into the Council on Foreign Relations of the secret societies. We talk about why did this happen? Because they wanted a war to bring about a one-world government. And we could talk at great length about how they created the First World War and the Boer War and the Spanish-American War and World War II, and just the American people must never be allowed to know that American corporations, General Motors, AT&T, Ford, IBM, and Exxon, and the American banks, were financing Adolf Hitler not only before the war, but during the war. And these same dark forces are at work today, moving us towards a war with Iran. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Let me suggest you go to our website, radioliberty.com, and read my April newsletter. And, if you do not have access to the computer, why, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you an April newsletter. We'll send you a catalog. We want you to have access to the information you're not going to get elsewhere. And these are the things, of course, that the people on Fox News and who have, you know, hundreds of radio outlets across America, the things that they're not going to tell you. Because these people are paid tremendous sums of money. They may appear to be the most patriotic people. They may say everything you believe. It's not what they say. It's what they intentionally delete. What they're paid so much to delete, not to tell you about, that's so important. To understand what's really going on today. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. I should say 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like to get our material. Our website, radioliberty.com. If you're in a position to help us, we'd love to hear from you. We need to maintain our network of stations across America. The American people must hear the truth before we go to war with Iran and the totally unnecessary war to bring about world peace.